back with Brandon and Matt. I am your favorite host, Matt, along with my sidekick, young Brandon
Richardson. Oh.
And I am your two-time reigning defending fantasy football champion. Yes, I just celebrated another title. But we're not living in the fantasy world. Today we are going to be talking about very real football. We're going to be talking about the glory years of West Point Army.
If we had to have a conversation about your fantasy sports awards, it would be a podcast in and of itself.
I thank you for that. Yeah. I'm
well, that is a compliment. Okay.
Yeah, no, I know. When you you want to talk about super teams, well, Army football in 1944, 45, 46, pretty ridiculous. But Matt's fantasy football team, I had Carson Wentz, Ezekiel Elliott, Julio Jones, DeAndre Hopkins. I mean, it goes on and on. So, yeah, we're talking about not quite as good of a super team as I had.
But they're comparable.
I had a Mr. Inside and I had a Mr. Outside. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, but those are guys you paid at the park, and that's not, that had nothing to do with football.
That Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside, I feel like that's describing my romantic life.
Again, I feel like we're going to end up doing a real disservice to the people later on in this podcast. But yes, definitely, we're going to be talking about the glory years of Army football, when Army was not only the best Army in the world, kicking everyone's ass out globally, but also the best football team in the nation, making them the best football team in the world, well, at least collegiately. And they had some real, three national titles in a row. A lot of people these days don't know a ton about it. It is something that we felt really deserved some coverage, and it is a hell of a story. If you like college football, if you like military history, if you like America in any way, shape, or form, or even if you don't, fuck you, listen anyways. But it's been a hell of a ride researching all this. This has probably been one of the ones I've had to dig in the deepest for. There's not as much information as you would think out there about that, about this, which is strange.
Yeah, it really is such a badass time, and I am, I'm becoming a history teacher, so I am probably my favorite period of history, little known, little studied time of the 20th century was World War II, and so this ties into all of that. Which I've already been a huge fan of and interested in. So seeing sort of, I don't know, the other side of it, what was going on here at home with West Point and with the Naval Academy, and we'll get into Notre Dame, and so many things that were going on at the time that were just very interesting, and definitely did not get their due, I think.
No,
in the annals of history.
It's like I said, surprising. I was surprised when we decided to do this topic. I thought there would definitely be a ton of stuff out there. I'm not saying that there's nothing out there, but I had to dig a lot harder than I would have thought. But this is also, it's really apropos. Army polished off a good year this year. Had an amazing game. This year's Army-Navy game, Army won a close-fought contest that had everything we look for in a good game. It had hard-nosed, fundamental-based football, played with passion and intensity, in a swirling snowstorm. The outcome wasn't decided until the last play, and Navy narrowly missed that 48-yard field goal, gave Army the 14-13 victory and the President's Cup, which I didn't really...
Yeah, the Commander-in-Chief Trophy,
okay.
Which, yeah, they played it in Philadelphia this year. They alternate usually between Philly and Baltimore NFL stadiums. So, yeah, the Army-Navy game represents everything that is right about college football and why the fans like us are so passionate about it, and the rivalries and the pageantry. And it's on another level that other professional sports and other mainstream sports really just don't – they don't really touch it in terms of tradition. And, you know, there's a romance and a mysticism to baseball that people have always talked about, but I don't know. It college football is definitely on its own level with,
and especially here, because here you don't have any other game where the two teams meet. I mean, this is an intense rivalry. I forget who said that Army and Navy are the best of friends in the world for 364 and a half days out of the year. But that half day, they play hard-nosed football, and they get after each other. But after that game, they stand for each other while they sing each other's – while the team sings the alma mater fight song, you know, like as a sign of respect. You don't see that anywhere else. I can't.
No,
it's hard for me. It's hard for me to say that.
Tremendous.
A little
yeah, I know. It's awesome. It's tremendous respect. And Army, you know, this is a wonderful time to talk about Army football, really. It's part of the reason we wanted to do this, because – Army had lost, I believe, 14 straight to
right.
Navy until last year. And so they just got two in a row, which is, like, unreal for them. And Navy has a great program, and they're always really, really competitive.
Right.
And so for Army to come out and pull that off, because, you know, we've seen years where Army has been one win, no wins. For a long time it was like that. And they've turned things around.
Years.
And they won a bowl game this year, and it's only their fifth bowl win in program history. And to put that into context, when they won these three national title games, or these three national titles, they weren't playing national title games. They weren't playing bowl games. This was a time where you would play the regular season. A lot of schools for many years refused to go to bowl games. Notre Dame was notorious that they wouldn't accept any bowl game bids, and they would just finish the regular season, and that was it. And I personally – wish they would have implemented that when they were 12-0 4 or 5 years ago when they went and played Alabama in the national title game. They should have just said, nope, we're going back to no bowl games. We're going to take our AP National Championship. We're not going to go get slaughtered by Alabama down in Miami. So it's a different time. So, yeah, they have a 5-2 bowl record, which – So getting a bowl win this year, it was a huge thing for the program. It's always a feel-good story whenever the service academies are doing well. These are guys that are going to serve in the country, and they're not all going to go make millions of dollars in the NFL. And they're playing against a lot of guys that are a lot of the time and still being able to execute and game plan and get victories. So
I think they represent the best in college sports, if not in sports in its entirety. They're the type of, I'm sure as someone you're planning on being a coach, and I'm sure, those are the type of athletes that everyone would want to coach. They're, no hassle, all very dedicated and disciplined. And it's a unique breed of cat that ends up at these.
My father was a college football coach, and he would always say that his dream job was to coach at a service academy, because the intelligence, the discipline, the focus, all the things that you want. You may not have the best athletes. You may get beat because the other team has more playmakers, but you're probably not going to get beat because you weren't prepared and you weren't focused and your guys.
Probably not.
Yeah,
I don't know if you do that, which is like the more that I spent a considerable amount of time this week on this script, on researching this, and the more that I researched it, the more that really sunk in. Couldn't agree more. If you wanted to be involved with an athletic program, if I had my druthers, I'd definitely pick this one or pick a military academy of some kind, because it's just a unique, especially for being, these guys are all 18 to 22. It's a very unique individual that's that disciplined and dedicated and focused at that age.
And the service academies have produced some incredible coaches. Greg Popovich, Mike Krzyzewski.
Lombardi. He wasn't head coach, but like he coached.
I'm saying those guys like went to service academies and they
in
the mix. And then, you know, Bill Belichick's father coached at Navy. And so he kind of grew up raised around that style, that system, and that program. So,
and we'll get into the graduates from West Point. You know, they have both of these, all of our service academies, the Army and Navy are the two oldest, have a real reverence. They're rooted in tradition. Did you see the new uniforms this year? Navy's uniforms were in tribute to the Blue Angels.
Badass.
Looked badass. Their uniforms are never not awesome. Army uniforms, they were all white, and they were a tribute to the 10th Mountain Division. The Army's official release said that the 10th Mountain Division was originally called the 10th Light Alpine Division, and they were trained in some harsh weather. These soldiers trained at 9,200 feet to learn to fight and survive in the most brutal mountain conditions. Bill Bowerman, who would eventually go on to co-found Nike, organized the supplies and maintained the mules for the 10th Mountain Division as a major in the Army, serving at the time as a commander of the 86th Regiment's 1st Battalion. A little trivia for you. Just toss that in there.
And if you saw the game, it was like a whiteout, basically. There was snow all over the field. And Army is wearing all white. There was a meme going around that said Army finally figured out how to do camouflage.
I mean, because, if you were playing them, it'd be tough to see them.
Yeah, there's a rule about Boise State not being allowed to wear their all blue uniforms on their blue turf.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same kind of advantage that Army had in that game.
And did you see the cleats on them? There's on the cleats, if you look up close, there's a panda patch, and that's a tribute to the 10th Mountain Division. They had their roots. I know you're a Colorado guy. They had their roots in Pando, Colorado. You know where Pando's at? You ever heard of Pando?
You know, as a Colorado native, I should, but I do not, actually.
Seems like if you were a Colorado native, you'd know about it.
Well, I think that that's probably a classified area. I don't think that's for civilians.
Well, in any case, they were, I'm sure.
It would be disrespectful for me to know where it was.
It's strange. It was easy enough to find on YouTube, Google. But the patch, anyways, I digress. The patch helped identify the soldiers, who were nicknamed the Pando Commandos. Catchy name there.
I like it.
The reverence for tradition, history, and service is, to be sure, uncommon in a sport replete with long-held traditions and deeply ingrained loyalties. Service academies have long been the standard bearer for all that is right in college athletics. Sacrifice, discipline, dedication, teamwork, and leadership, a list which is hard to type out without tearing up a little bit if you're a real American. However, in today's day and age, it can be a hard sell to persuade young athletes It's harder to persuade a young athlete to come into a highly disciplined environment, which they will receive no special treatment over other college programs where they can kind of get away and fuck off and do what they want. Which, I mean, you can argue back and forth that, no, that doesn't happen in my college, but come on.
Yeah, it's definitely, we've kind of talked about this too. There's a certain type of person who aspires to go to a service academy, and it's atypical to find someone who is cut from that cloth. And you really start at a young age. When you want to go to a service, you know, it's one of those things that kind of like, you know, from the time you're a kid and you work towards it, because you have
it
to
sure
have.
It seems like it.
You have to have so many things in order, and, you know, a clean history and SATs and GPA and all these things.
Right.
And, you know, we'll get into more of that later, but yeah,
it seems like it would be a hard sell to get somebody who's also going on recruiting trips to, let's say, USC or Miami to.
Well, and I don't think that they really get a lot of those guys, you know. There's kind of two worlds of college football.
You're taking on an entirely different college experience base, no matter what your other options are. There's,
yeah, when you think about going to college,
entirely different experience.
You want to go to college, you want to get hammered, you want to get pooned, you want to yuck it up, you want to do all these things. Well, it's not exactly what you're going to be doing if you go to a service academy. And they come through, and I'm just down the road here from USAFA, also known as United States Air Force Academy. And we had a buddy who worked there for many years and worked with the cadets. And
right.
You know, they're highly functioning young adults and
sure.
They're
young adults, though.
But, yeah, they're still kids, and they still do a lot of bonehead stuff.
Sure.
And they have traditions where they'll, you know, beat the shit out of each other and all kinds of, you know, they just like with the first snow of the year, they all go out and have this big snow fight here. And there's kids that'll end up getting gashing their eyebrows open and having to get stitches and stair strips and busted lips and teeth missing. And, you know,
all in a good time.
But when they have that, when you're in that high tension environment for that long, you know, you're going to have to cut loose. And I think that they understand they have to let these guys have some fun. And there's really nothing funner that you can do than beat another service academy in a football game, I think, if you go to one of these schools.
Oh, my goodness. It seems like the best thing in the world. And you've been to a military academy yourself, right? At least briefly. A minute.
Well, it wasn't an academy. I went to a institute.
Institute, yes.
Yeah, I was in New Mexico Military Institute for like a summer semester. And when I was there during the summer, it was a lot more lax. It wasn't as regimented as it is during the year. But it was still pretty orderly. And a lot of the people that I went to school that semester, you know, a lot of them were going there because they wanted to go to West Point. So many people, and it was their whole life. Everything they were doing was to to get a better resume for West Point to, you know, to build that application so that they could be accepted there. And we went to high school with a guy who ended up going to West Point, and he was one of the what do they call it, like the Black Knight, like parachute guys. And he actually parachuted into one of the Army Navy games. So but you know, again, he was, you know, 1500-1600 SAT or whatever, 4 point something GPA, and athlete, student body, the list goes on and on and on.
Basically just another guy there at West Point.
Yeah. And when they sent me, you know, my dad, his father sent him to a military institute. My dad sent me to one because I was being too rambunctious. And the thing is, though, there's a lot of those guys that are there who they're hardcore type A. They want to go to a service academy, all that good stuff. But then there's a lot of guys they send, like me, who are partying too much, who were being rambunctious, who were hanging out with kids who were doping. And
would you say that you were just being rebellion?
I was, yeah. I mean, I had never gone to the script club, but I was certainly being rebellion. That's the Adam Pac-Man Jones reference. And look up a great interview by Adam Pac-Man Jones. But anyway, so they sent us all this. And then it's in New Mexico, and there was a bunch of wealthy Mexican nationals from Juarez who were there. So all of us got together, and, you know, we were getting rambunctious. We were being rebellion. They put all the bad seeds together. And so in that sense, it was the most fun summer I've ever had. it was awesome. And so all these people are kind of there, and we're kind of in this camp. And we have all these former military guys and former drill sergeants and stuff who are in charge of us and watching us. But it's kind of like being in prison or something. We still found a way to get around things and get away with stuff. So
now, see, that is going to be that makes it a hard sell then to get if you're a great athlete. It's going to be, if you're the best blue chip running back in the country, it's going to be a hard sell to take that and live in that kind of austere, disciplined environment, right? Like it used to be like, well, if you're the best in the country, you want to go to the toughest team. And it's like, well, of course you want to go to Army.
Well, it really puts into perspective, when you look at it through the current climate of college football, how amazing it was that Army was that good in the 1940s. And we'll get into a lot of the reasons why they were that good, and obviously, you know, with World War II and everything. But, you know, the idea of Army ever competing for a national championship now, it's like unfathomable.
Yeah, with all due respect, it just doesn't – yeah. But there was a time when the best athletes in the country sought to play on the Army football team. After all, what better place to play a game that is essentially simulated war than at the most prestigious land warfare military academy in the world? For many years, the football team at West Point was considered the best in the country, While this distinction has been diluted by blue chips prospects, pussies, often choosing glitzier, more glamorous programs, the legacy of West Point and the standards by which it abides have not changed. West Point standards are extremely exacting, with a 9% acceptance rate, which, to put that even more perspective, means 91% of the people that apply don't get in.
And to put that into even further perspective, the college I just recently graduated from, I think, is about an 88% acceptance rate. So
that's the Hollywood Upstairs Medical School. No, Matt is he's actually been touted as one of the finest alumni students to ever come out of UCCS. Is that right? UCCS?
Yeah. Yeah, one of my professors bestowed that honor upon me, and yeah, it means a lot. It's a very humbling. I'm already a very humble guy. So
it sure is. Humble and rambunctious. Could never make it.
I come from the humblest of beginnings, and so it's,
you sure do.
Yeah,
you come from. Let's emphasize that. Really humble beginnings. No, but the average GPA of an incoming freshman or plebe is 3.74, which is fucking way up there. They have an average SAT score of 1340, which is like, it's up there. The requirements for application include nomination from an approved source. The Department of Defense qualifying medical examination must be passed. They must be at least 17, but not yet 23 years of age by July 1st of their year of entry. And they have to be an unmarried U.S. citizen or a foreign national with approval. I don't know about that one. No parental obligations are required for freshmen. Two types of nominations. They can have two types of nominations to get into West Point, but you got to have one of these. So one of these people can nominate you. You have to have one of these types of people nominate you. The vice president, U.S. senator, a U.S. representative, a delegate to the House of Representatives from Washington, D.C., the Mariana Islands, Guam, American Samoa, or the Virgin Islands. The governor of Puerto Rico can nominate you. The resident commissioner of Puerto Rico can also nominate you if the governor's busy. And the secretary of the army can nominate you. Or you can get in what's called service-connected members. And we were talking about this before the podcast. If you're a son or daughter of a career military personnel, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, or Coast Guard, that'll get you a service-connected member nomination. If you're a regular or reserve component of the Army Reserve or Army National Guard, or if you're the son or daughter of a deceased or disabled Armed Force veteran, or the son or daughter of a person awarded the Medal of Honor, which I think is pretty fair. We're talking about
that. And let me just say that if you are a congressional representative and you have someone in your district with a 3.75 GPA,
right,
a 1350 SAT, and you're
who's
not willing to
the
give them a
honor
nomination, you're an asshole.
You're
okay?
An asshole. Let's put that back stance for the day. Daily life at West Point. It's when you compare this. This is, and none of this is meant to disparage the average college athlete, because that has its own demands and it and disciplines. But it's still much more lax than what someone at West Point would be going through. And this is not just students. This is West Point has a maxim that we'll talk about later called every cadet an athlete. So whether you're playing a sport or whether you're an average student, this is what your typical day would look like. 6:55 to 7:30 in the morning, breakfast. 7:35 to 11:45, class or study. 12:05 to 12:40, lunch. 12:45 to 1:40, commandant or dean time. I don't know what that means, but it's in there. 1:50 to 3:50, class or study. And then 4:10 to 5:45, they're missing 20 minutes in there. I don't know what's happening. That's on the taxpayer's dollar. Intramural.
Lazy
club, intramural club or intercollegiate athletic. I don't know why you let me read this shit. Extracurricular activities or free time. So it means every cadet's an athlete, and they've had the same gym for, and I forgot to write down the name of it, but they've had the same gym forever. So they all have gym time every single day, whether you're an athlete or not. Then 6:30 to 7:15 is supper, optional except for Thursday. So Thursdays, fuck you, you gotta come. 7:15 to 7:30 cadet duties, 7:30 to 8:30 study conditions and extracurricular activities, and then 8:30 to 11:30 more study time. 11:30 they play taps and lower the flag, and at midnight lights out. And you wake up the next day to do it all over again. Does that sound familiar at all?
It kind of looks like you're what you make yourself do on a daily basis, anyways.
Yeah,
so.
You shifted those times about 2 hours somewhere in there. Yeah. That's my ideal day.
Yeah,
I don't have any cadet. I don't have any cadet duties. This is the only difference.
Well,
oh,
the cadet,
that, yeah,
they're just limited. You know, they're not as rigid.
But you're saying that like it's a weird thing.
You do love intramural sports though, so we have to.
I'm one of the best intramural athletes I've ever seen.
And the schedule that I kept when I was at the New Mexico military was, you know, we would get up, we would go, we would eat breakfast, we would go to class, then we always in class for like, I don't know, like 3 or 4 hours, and then we'd have lunch, and then there was more class. Then I worked out with the football team, and the football player said, yeah, playing football is actually gives you more free time than if you didn't, because like if you have like a Thursday walkthrough or something, they'll keep you for a half an hour or so.
Oh,
then you
yeah.
can go back to your room and sleep for those 2 hours, extra time that you had. So any free time you have, yeah, I mean, it's super regimented. Time goes by fast. It's weird. There's not a lot of girls there. I did have a girlfriend. She was probably the second or third most attractive girl that was at the school. So not the best,
wow.
but still pretty solid. Still pretty solid. And
if you are that girl and you are a listener, shoot us a line, and we would love to reunite you two.
Yeah. Well, she went to Arizona State, so I think I'm good off of. I think she's been through a lot.
Through the fork.
Physically. And, yeah, but anyways, and they do these things too. Like when you're studying, you can either go to, study groups or library meeting or whatever, but a lot of times you would just stay in your room. And I had, the way it's set up is you'll have a desk, and then there'll be like sort of a bunk bed on top of it where you sleep, and then you have a closet, and the rooms are mirror images, and you have a roommate. And my roommate was this goofy kid from, I think he was from Las Cruces. Yeah. And he'd kind of get this cabin fever though, when he spent so much time, and this kid became like fascinated with the quotes that I would say, and he started writing. He took a notebook and he started writing a book of that, and he started writing down my quotes,
God.
And then he would read them back to me.
Oh no!
Yeah,
no, that's. I do my best to quell his ego, but
yeah.
It doesn't do much. Doesn't help me much when someone's out there writing something called the Book of Matt.
Yeah, well, I think he even made out with my girlfriend too, which was not cool. She cheated on me with a bunch of different guys. It didn't work out. So, but it did work out in the end, you know,
well,
I'm in a good spot right now. So, yeah.
Like I said, if you're listening, shoot us a line.
But while you're doing your homework, you know, that evening study period, you're sitting there and there's guys who are like retired military guys who now work there, and they're walking the halls and they're looking in your window, and you have to have your blinds up. It was the closest thing that reminded me of when I took a tour of Alcatraz in San Francisco.
Sounds like it, yeah.
It definitely feels like you're in this sort of like detention center type of environment. And I don't know.
Thank you.
I think, I mean, I have to, and I know that is basically based off of the service academies, universities, you know, that.
Right. Oh, for sure.
So it's a similar thing. They use similar persuasion techniques to get people to do what they want and to get them to buy in and all that kind of stuff.
Well, they've been doing it for a long time. West Point's been around for a long time. All this stuff's been set in stone for fucking ever. They've been around since Jefferson became president. He called for signing a legislation that established a Corps of Engineers. Then he said that shall be stationed at West Point, which is like this point to the west to New York at this confluence of these rivers.
But the point that is west of New York is a little
bigger. He did that on 16th of March, 1802. Jefferson wanted a national university that focused on science and engineering and was looking for an American with strong scientific background to command the academy. In 1801, he found his man in Jonathan Williams. Though he had no previous military experience, Williams was a well-known scientist of his day and a relative of Ben Franklin, which is pretty good creds in and of itself. Williams accepted Jefferson's appointment to the rank of colonel and arrived to assume his post on 14th December, 1801.
And I just want to add real quick, because for those of you who have also listened to our UFC episode, you know that Brian Kilmeade, cage side reporter, is also a purveyor of United States history books that he's been writing.
A fine purveyor of United States.
Just came out with a new one on Andrew Jackson and the Battle of New Orleans that I'm looking forward to reading very soon, haven't gotten to yet. But in his book, George Washington and the Secret Six, he talks about the spy ring that helped to sort of save the American Revolution cause. And one of the things that is a huge storyline in it is Benedict Arnold attempting to give West Point over to the crown, to the Tories, to these motherfuckers, then...
You see, you know he's sucking dick in hell. You know Benedict Arnold.
And George Washington said, uh-uh, and aspiring basically... and he wanted to turn it over to them while George Washington was there. I mean, just a real piece of shit. Then there was this spy, John Andre, that they caught who found, he's a heel for sure as you're reading the book.
He's a heel, motherfucker.
He's an actor. He's an intellectual. He slept with all these women in Philadelphia and all the cities he was in. He was like I think he was a major in the British Royal. I don't know if it was Army or Navy, but anyways, yeah. So it gets known, and then George Washington captures John Andre, and Benedict Arnold escapes, and obviously they don't get West Point. That shit is not going down. George Washington offers to trade John Andre for Benedict Arnold, and they refuse. So then Washington has Andre hanged. And that's and he had respect for Andre, and he said he's just, you know, basically all in the game, yo, to quote Omar from The Wire, or to quote the 209 area of California, fuck around, lay around. So
if you fuck around, you will lay around.
You what are you doing, John Andre? Oh, just hanging out.
Just hanging out, man.
Just gonna hang here for a while. But so the history of West Point is linked intrinsically to the American Revolution and the history
Absolutely.
Of America. It's pretty wild.
It's been around since the beginning, literally. The early years of the academy were a tumultuous time with few standards for admission or length of study. It was kind of like all in who you knew. Cadets ranged in age from 10 to 37 years old. And attended between 6 months to 6 years, which is like, hey, fuck it, man. It was very transient.
So if you were a 10-year-old and you went there for 6 months, could you then become a 4-star general?
You could, or you could be a 37-year-old and be there till you're 43 years old and just get a regular degree there.
And just become a lieutenant.
I mean, it's fucking 10-year-old. How could you let a 10-year-old in the West Point? What the fuck could you possibly do?
That has to be some kind of,
That's
like,
a hell of a 10-year-old.
Whiz kid.
He's a Doogie Howser.
I didn't know we had immigrants from East India that long ago.
He's like fucking Sheldon from Big Bang Theory, but
that's
not such an unbearable little cunt. The impending war of 1812 caused Congress to
I'll leave my Big Bang Theory takes out. But yeah.
Well, that's my entire Big Bang Theory take right there. They're all a bunch of cunts.
They had these videos. Let me just say this. They had these videos
where... Oh, yeah, I'd love to hear this.
We're just going to go off the rails here for a minute. Bear with us, folks. But they have videos of the Big Bang Theory where they removed the laugh track. And so it's just awkward conversation and then long pauses. And but it's not funny. It's like the humor is within. It's kind of like you kind of have that propensity for social anxiety or awkward
right,
social behavior to like to get it. Yeah. And two confident young alpha males like us, it just doesn't resonate. So
no, it doesn't. It sure doesn't.
To all you Big Bang fans out there, though, thank you for your support. Can't wait to watch Young Sheldon.
Yeah, less time watching Big Bang, more time on Back. It'll do you some good. We'll get you laid. The impending war of 1812 caused Congress to authorize a more formal system of education at the academy and increase the size of the Corps of Cadets to 250. By the War of 1812, only 89 officers had graduated. Morale was low, and the academy was in danger of being disbanded. But in 1811, graduate George Ronan, assigned to duty at Fort Dearborn on the American frontier, was killed. This is the first guy that was killed in combat. George Ronan was killed in the War of 1812 and became the first member of the Corps of Cadets to die in combat, which is a unique distinction to this to U.S. military academies. A lot of the guys that we talk about, obviously more so than most because it's a military academy, but you see a lot of these star players, people that had seminal pivotal roles in football teams and athletic teams, and then a couple of years later they're 3,000 miles away, dead somewhere. It's a intense environment.
It's you know, obviously we have like a modern day example would be Pat Tillman.
Yep.
And how he forewent the NFL to go to Afghanistan. And we all know how shocking that is in, you know, the reverence we have for his service and sacrifice. So, yeah, you can only imagine how they felt at the time when these college stars ended up losing their lives on the battlefield.
And it's a matter of perspective, too, because, like, they're the people that we're going to talk about their accomplishment on the field, however great it may have been, still wasn't like the biggest thing that they contributed, which is that makes it a pretty unique set of circumstances when you're talking college athletics. Because usually it's the pinnacle of someone's life. It's like the greatest thing that they ever did. But for most of these people, it was just something else that they did in the much greater picture of their lives. But in 1817, Colonel Sylvanus Thayer, which is a hell of a name, became the superintendent, and he kind of made he's the guy that turned shit around. He knocked off the 10-year-olds at West Point. He's known as the father of the military academy. He upgraded academic standards, instilled military discipline, and emphasized honorable conduct. He also created a teaching method known today as the Thayer method, which emphasizes self-study and daily homework, as well as a small class size.
That son of a bitch invented homework. Thanks
a
lot.
He invented homework. But
wow.
He straightened out West Point. We still have 10 years.
He ended the West Point Elementary Academy. And
we needed those kids. Thayer made civil engineering.
To be fair, people were only living to 40 years a lot of the time back then.
Yeah,
those
kids were well past their life expectancy. No, that's a historical myth. It's low birth rates, but
I know.
hell, everybody knows by now. And if you don't know, Google it. Spend less time on fucking Big Bang Theory. You should know that by now. Famous graduates and cadets that have gone there. There's been a ton of people that have gone through the courses at West Point. Graduates at West Point have gone on to shape national and world history in countless ways. There have been. I was trying to compile a list of graduates from that would be like influential people from the Wikipedia page, and I had to just compile a list of categories. This is a list of categories of graduates that are on the Wikipedia page. Presidents, governors, generals, titans of industry, astronauts, and more. Which is what the fuck are you talking about? What do you mean astronauts, you know? It's plural. Titans of industry, governors, presidents. So there was Ulysses. There's several people that are on. These people all went to the. We're not going to get into all these people's roles in history, but they span.
Some of them go without saying.
Right, but they're on all different sides of the field here. So some of these people are well known, and some of these people are famous. Some of them are infamous. Let's say Ulysses S. Grant, Robert E. Lee, George Armstrong Custer, Jefferson Davis, George Patton, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Buzz Aldrin, Douglas MacArthur, David Petraeus, Stanley McChrystal, and Norman Schwarzkopf, just to name a few.
And there were some people who attended who might have not finished that are like Edgar Allan Poe.
Right.
Probably maybe the most iconic American author of all time. And one of the greatest country music songwriters of all time, Kris Kristofferson, also an incredible actor.
I thought you were going to say that Edgar Allan Poe was one of the greatest country music singers of all time.
Well,
I wasn't
going to
argue. That was good. Yeah. Fair enough. No, but yeah, Kris Kristofferson as well.
Nevermore.
He had a teaching appointment to West Point that he forego, something like that. He passed it up in order to move to Nashville.
Yeah. And you can see him in the Blade trilogy.
That's a proud, well-known West Point tradition. Ambrose Burnside also went there. He's a Civil War general, and these are like guys that would be well known in popular culture. Ambrose Burnside is not the inventor of the sideburn, but the guy who gave it the name of sideburns. He was the first guy with a big, huge.
His name is Burnside.
Well, yeah,
and he invented the sideburn.
that couldn't make
you,
it up.
And that's not a rib.
it's a shoot. In fact, Edward A. Murphy Jr., the inventor of Murphy's Law, must have been a real fuck up, because right. Henry Martin Robert. He
think about all the
Robert
stuff that went wrong
Robert.
For that guy.
That's what
come
I'm
up
saying.
With
like. They named it after you.
And everything just went wrong in that guy's life.
Just a massive fuck-up. But United States Military Academy, which is like the formal name for West Point Athletics, they didn't really get going in earnest until 1890, when a cadet named Dennis Mitchie saw the Naval Academy's football team practicing and wanting in on the game, and a prospective rivalry between them and the midshipmen convinced the midshipmen to issue a quote-unquote challenge to the brass at West Point, which is like something it was fake, to put together a football team to face them in this burgeoning and violent sport. Initially, Mitchie's request was denied, but well known to be headstrong and persistent, Mitchie eventually convinced Academy higher-ups of the intrinsic value of a football program. Mitchie served as team captain in 1891 when the Black Knights opened the season with the program and their initial victory of a 10-6 win over Fordham, and later avenged their 1890 loss to Navy with a 32-16 trouncing of the midshipmen, which really sounds like an early 20th century sports talk.
Yeah, was it really a trouncing?
A 32-16 trouncing.
They doubled them up.
Excuse me. Upon graduation, Mitchie remained at the academy, directing Army to a 3-1-1 record, hell of a record for a football season, as a head football coach in the fall of 1892. Sadly, Mitchie, who had reached the rank of captain, was killed in action on San Juan Hill in 1898 during the Spanish-American War.
Wow. And for those of you that think the only thing that happened in 1892 was Abercrombie and Fitch being invented, well, here you go.
Here you go. There are two things that happened that year.
And we also kind of, as we go through, when you look at football back in, you know, the late 19th century, completely different game. You know, there, we didn't
more
have,
akin to rugby, maybe?
Yeah, there was not like the forward pass type of
right.
thing going on. And you see these really abbreviated seasons. And it was kind of started more as like a club sport. It wasn't
right.
this mastodon of, you know, the number two sport in the United States of America is college football, behind professional football.
Professional, right.
So we are 1 and 1A. It's football. And but it wasn't always the case. It came from humble beginnings, just like myself.
Yes, just like Matt. You can pretty much trace anything we talk about back to the lineage of Matt O'Brien and his journey through life.
Right here in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado.
And somehow, through it all, he's managed to stay humble.
Thank you.
Now, for many years, Army teams were known as the Cadets. In the 1940s, several papers called this football team the Black Knights of the Hudson. And from then on, Cadets and Black Knights were used interchangeably until 1999, when the team was officially nicknamed the Black Knights. The official mascot for the Black Knights is the Mule.
So I just want to add quickly, we're talking about the mascot now, and we did just talk about a lot of the famous people who came through West Point. Well, as we know, the NHL just had an expansion franchise this year to go to 31 teams, the Vegas Golden Knights. Now, the owner of the Vegas Golden Knights is a West Point graduate. And the reason chose the Golden Knights is because he wanted to base it off of the Army's Black Knights mascot.
Hell yeah.
And I like the I think Golden Knights is a good name, but I think if you called it Vegas Knights with a K, it has a little more pop for me.
That's got some pop to it. I got to hand that to you.
It's got a little double entendre. Got a little multiple meaning there. But the Golden Knights, golden is a persuasive term. It is, you know, especially for Las Vegas when you're thinking about cash money. But kind of just to see the reach even further into this day in mainstream sports of West Point.
Now, I would contend that if he wanted to really name his team, he would have named them like the Golden Mules or the Las Vegas Mules. Now, that's got pop to it.
The Bad Asses.
They, you know, when I was looking, so I looked up all this stuff on the genealogy of mules. There is a...
Yeah, I was wondering how all of this was going to tie into the episode, because you really, really were getting into the genealogy of mules more than I expected to ever have anyone do.
Well, you're welcome. There's actually, if you look up the mule on the Wikipedia page, all these animals that are linked to it, there's an animal called the African wild ass. It's a real thing. Go check it out. So the mule, though, is a offspring of a male donkey and a female horse. Horses and donkeys are different species with different numbers of chromosomes on the end of F1 hybrids, first-generation hybrids, meaning between these two species, a mule is easier to obtain than a hinny. A hinny is the offspring of a female donkey, which is called a jinny, and a male horse, which is called a stallion. Now, I know you're curious, the size of a mule is it's dependent on the work that it's put to. And it'll largely depend on the breeding of the mule's female parent. Now, mules can be lightweight, medium weight, or when they're produced from a draft horse mare, moderately heavy. Mules are reputed to be more patient, hardy, and long-lived than horses, and are described as less obstinate and more intelligent than a donkey. This is why they've been used historically all throughout history in warfare as pack animals. Because of this, they're virtually synonymous with land warfare up until the mid to early 20th century, let's say. So as
so
an homage,
they were used in World War One.
I don't know that the U.S. Army used them extensively. The last time I would be able to confidently say without researching it would probably be the Spanish-American War.
Yeah. And mules are infertile?
Yes. That's both mules and jinnies, I believe, are infertile. And what was the other thing I wanted to get to? Just go look up a picture of a jinny. They're just ugly, runty little bastards. No one would want a jinny. They are. They're just ugly, runtier little... It looks like Eeyore was more of a jinny.
Forrest wanted a
Jenny. Well, it's a major mistake. If you're in the Jenny market, get out. Go for the mule. It looks like Eeyore's fucking depressed girlfriend that's on Xanax. It's just a bummed out, smaller looking mule. Yeah.
Well, so they're sad because they can't get pregnant. So,
I guess so. It must be a bummer.
Maybe that's why Eeyore was so sad, because his dick didn't work.
Yeah, well, at least he doesn't have to pay child support.
If I was Eeyore, I would just be running through it. No consequences.
Turning through it. You want to come back to my fucking knocking that shed down every night? Come back to my stick shed. What a lazy piece of shit.
The 100 acres. That's all mine.
The army mules are a group of mules which serve as, so there's actually like a group of mules, like a three or four of them that serve as mascots for the United States Military Academy. The tradition of mules as mascots dates back for the Army to 1899 when an officer at the Philadelphia Quartermaster Depot decided that the team needed a mascot to counter the Navy goat. Mules are an obvious choice as they were used as haulers for Army gear for generations. Not much is known about the official mules until 1936 when Mr. Jackson, named for Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson, a former Army pack mule, arrived from Front Royal, Virginia. He served for 12 years, presiding over two national championship teams. Starting with Mr. Jackson, there have been 17 official Army mules, only one, Buckshot, being female. The current mule corps are, drumroll please, except I fucking lost it on my computer scroll.
I can tell you're a guitar player.
Yeah, that's true. Ranger 3 is the star of the show here. He was formerly known as Jack. I guess they changed his name to Ranger 3.
The artist formerly known as Jack.
They had a bunch of them named Ranger out of a tribute to the Ranger, 76th Ranger Regiment and all the Rangers past and present. Ranger 3 came to the Academy in 2011 as a gift from a gift of Steve Towns, class of 1975. He stands at 16.22 hands, and that's how they measure horses, 66 inches, 168 centimeters if you're a socialist. And and he's the son of a Percheron man. Striker, which is an awesome name. They spell it with a Y. It's like a fucking 80s metal band. Striker is half, right? It's a half. He's a half brother of Ranger 3.
Oh.
He's also trained by Major Ann Hessinger and gifted by Steve Towns. Striker stands at a height slightly shorter than his brother. And then there's Paladin, formerly known as Apache and Rocky.
Why? First of all, can I just say, why can't these guys just stick with a name? I'm not really understanding why.
Well, it's like when Stone Cold
Steve Austin
was like a $6 million man.
They just can't stick with a name. Mules are very fickle about their name.
They got to run through a couple gimmicks.
He was Apache, then he was Rocky, but now he's really into this Paladin phase.
Well, it's like Love and Cactus Jack. They switch in between.
Yeah, can he show up at a game as Apache or Rocky, depending on what?
Well, it depends on the storyline. It depends what Vince McMahon says.
And let me just say, live mascots, you kind of only see them in college football. We have Uga at Georgia. We have Ralphie at my beloved University of Colorado, the Buffalo. We have
Bevo.
I think LSU, the Tiger, is the Tiger's name Mike or something? They have this $5 million habitat they built for this Tiger.
We got Bevo here in Austin. There's that.
Yeah.
There's what's the name of the bulldog at A&M?
I only recognize Uga.
They got
at
that
Georgia.
Fucking horse at USC, but I think somebody shot him last year. I don't know, maybe.
He's glue now.
Google it.
His name is Elmer's.
Yeah, his name's fucking gone. That's what his name is.
Yeah, we don't hate horses. We just have a rivalry with the University of Southern California.
I prefer mules.
And, we'll get into my love of Notre Dame. Will probably be undeniable here shortly when we start talking about some of these football seasons for Army that we're going to get into.
Absolutely. It comes in. They butt heads quite a few times. The Army mules they're trained by a corps of cadet mule riders, a part of the Spirit Support Activity for the U.S. Corps of Cadets. You gotta really rename that. The mules serve not only as West Point's mascot, but also as a mascot for the entire United States Army, which I really fucking dig. I think that's pretty cool. It's a good animal to have represent you, especially if you're the Army.
You carry the load for
I dig it. So from 1890 to World War One, many of the famous graduates in the 20th century graduated during the 15-year period between 1900 and 1915. It's a short list here. From the class of 1903, Douglas MacArthur. From the class of 1904, Joseph Stilwell. From the class of 1907, Henry Hap Arnold. From the class of 1909, George S. Patton, who was an Olympian. I didn't realize that, an Olympic decathlete. Then in 1915, both Omar Bradley and Dwight D. Eisenhower graduated. And the class of 1915 was known as the class the stars fell upon for the exceptionally high percentage of general officers, 59 out of the 164 graduates became generals. And this period also saw the infancy of intercollegiate athletics at the academy. Now, from 1920 to the start of World War II, one of the academy's most distinguished graduates and a decorated World War I soldier and leader, Douglas MacArthur, became superintendent in 1919, which is like, holy shit, Douglas MacArthur is your superintendent?
Teach me how to Dougie.
So, yo, Dougie.
The corn cob.
Yo, Dougie. What up, Big Mac Attack? He instituted sweeping reforms to the academic process, introducing a greater emphasis on history and humanities. So I thought it was really interesting because it's like, comes back from World War I and decides that what needs to be emphasized is the history and humanities for teaching his officers. He began the process of having instructors study at civilian institutions prior to serving at West Point, and he provided more liberal leave and pass opportunities to the upper classes. He made major changes to the field training regimen, and the Cadet Honor Committee was formed under his watch in 1922. MacArthur was a firm supporter of athletics at the academy. As he famously said, upon the fields of friendly strife are sown the seeds that upon other fields on other days will bear the fruits of victory. West Point became an officially accredited institution of the Association of American Universities in 1925. So they're bona fide now.
Big time.
And in 1933, they officially began granting the title of Bachelor of Science to all graduates, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into the meat of it. 12:40 p.m. on August 31st, 1939.
Here we go, baby.
No good son of a bitch named Hitler ordered, named Adolf Hitler, ordered hostilities against Poland to start at 4:45 a.m. the next morning. The invasion began as ordered. In response, Great Britain and France declared war on Germany on September 3rd at 11 a.m. and on 5 a.m. respectively. World War II.
Of course, France dicked around for 6 hours.
And that's not like, right. You had to dick around for 6 hours. Just get down to
what
it.
What are you guys doing for 6 hours?
What are you? They're right next door. They're right there.
They're eating crepes and.
Yeah. If you're looking for France apologists on this podcast, you've come to the wrong place. So then on December 7th,
let's continue with how we saved France and wiped off the face of the earth for a second time in 20 years.
Yeah, you're welcome. Twice. On December 7th, 1941, Japan decided to royally fuck up forever and bomb the U.S. naval base Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and the United States found itself thrust into global conflict. Now, let me say real quick, I don't give a fuck about your oil embargoes. Fuck you. You bombed Pearl Harbor, and we came back, and we fucking got you. I don't want to hear any more bitching. That's all I have to say about that.
What do you think about the conspiracy theories regarding FDR's prior knowledge of that and whether he wanted that to have that as a political tool so that it would champion the cause of war and make the people who didn't want to go to war in the United States change the opinion? And was it used as basically a Sun Tzu, you know, war is always deception? So
when it comes to that, on that level, I tend to err on the side that they're not competent enough to pull it off on that level. I don't know that. I think Japan was mad about the embargoes. I think he wasn't entirely unhappy. I think it gave him the reason he was looking for FDR to get in the war.
Jurisprudence.
I mean, you know a little bit more about World War II in general than I do. So give him like a breakdown of kind of what the war meant to the country and exactly what was going to be.
You're being too kind.
I have a tendency to do that.
Well, I would say that, you know, my thoughts are, I think there's a lot of the story of World War II that we do not know. So what people may or may not have known and why decisions were made, I mean, the possibility is that maybe FDR felt that if there was an attack that was imminent, that it would be better to have the ships in that harbor where they could be salvageable and brought back up and recovered instead of, you know, kind of being lost in the middle of the Pacific or something like that. But...
which I can understand. But regardless, we are in a war now, right? And what this...
Yeah.
I think most people in retrospect would look back and say it's a necessary war, but it also, I think they underestimate what it required on like a day-to-day basis as far as like what it required of people in their homes, people in their schools, people obviously in the athletic teams and in the sports world. It affected everything.
And FDR did a brilliant job of taking that tragedy and, you know, his ability as a public speaker is incredible, you know, looking back on it. And you know, the day that we'll live in infamy speech.
He's a stand-up guy.
Well, now we're just going to be sophomoric, I guess.
I admire some of the man's excellence.
Yeah, but you, Vader and his influence and his ability to, you know, kind of the way he was able to rally the country behind that tragedy. It's pretty impressive. You have to give him credit for that.
Yes. Yeah, there's things he's done that I'm a fan of, things he's done that I'm not. But, you
certainly.
Know, you can take the, if we take the, your, take the political spin off of the war, you can just say, look at it objectively and say, look at the sacrifice that it took on a micro scale, on a macro scale, like what effect it had on every front of American life, and it took its toll on everyone. From, you know, like everyone had someone that they knew that was serving in the war. They were rationing. They were. It's something that's hard for people born in our day and age to really, I think, wrap their mind around. Because even after 9/11, we weren't rationing chocolate. You know, it was a different time.
Well,
different...
speak for yourself. I actually love my country, so.
I actually went Atkins right after 9/11. 9/12.
This asshole made zero changes to his chocolate intake after 9/11. What a piece
just
of shit.
Kept right on eating that chocolate.
I guess if you quit eating chocolate, then the terrorists really would have won.
Terrorists win,
so.
Yeah, for sure. That's 100%.
Certainly.
But it's a unique thing. It created conditions for a country that was looking for, especially a team like Army, to come in and succeed during this time. You know, it was something that really mattered.
The 1920s, right? We had Prohibition, we had the gangster era, we had the booming economy. Then the 1930s, we had the Depression. The Dust Bowl, we had a lot of desolation, economic strife going on. And then World War II comes and everybody comes together. And the amount of nationalism, if you've seen the film Yankee Doodle Dandy with James Cagney, where he plays FDR, and it is so in your face, hardcore patriotism. I know a lot of the sort of millennial generation, they don't like it. They can't understand it. They don't get why people would love it. And
right.
We don't care how on the nose it is. But when I think about both my grandfathers and their brothers, were in the Navy and the Army fighting in World War II. It wasn't a certain thing, you know. People, the story on the news was the rape of Nanking. It was the atrocities that were being committed by the Japanese and the Nazis and the Italians. And the idea,
you know, there's the Amazon original Man in the High Castle based on, is it a Philip K. Dick novel or is it somebody else? I don't know. But anyways, it basically is a revisionist history. It supposes that the Axis won and the United States is under this thing, which, well, it's impossible because it would become a 50 statewide Alamo before that would happen.
Hell yeah. That's for real. That's 100%.
I don't think so. From my cold dead hands, buddy.
Totally.
But this is the climate, you know. We don't even know if this country, which has only been around for less, you know, 150 years at this point,
right,
who there are still living veterans of the Civil War that tore this country
right
apart, who just experienced the craziest global conflict of all time in World War One a generation
yep
before. We don't have this. You know, we have this sort of vanity now in the way we look at this country. It's just a given that we get to live in America, and it's the greatest country in the world. It's the most powerful economy, and all these things about it are kind of taken for granted now and even looked down upon.
Sure.
But back in the early 1940s, that was not the case. You know, we were under attack, and, yeah, there was a lot of propaganda. There was a lot of dehumanizing of the enemy. But if you really want to know, go read about the Rape of Nanking.
Go read about the Rape of Nanking and get back to me about the
And then, you know, imagine being in California where after we want to talk about college football. Well, the Rose Bowl was moved to Durham, North Carolina, to Duke Stadium because they were afraid that kamikaze fighters were going to come and dive bomb the Rose Bowl and kill the people there. And then when you hear about the atrocities and the rapes and like if you've read Ghost Soldiers, I mean, the horrible things they did in the Philippines and throughout Asia, it's unfathomable, really, the lack of humanity that was shown.
It's some of the worst
people
stuff that's ever happened in warfare. And that's
And so, you know, if you're living on the West Coast, you think this is coming to us. They did this there. They're going to do this here. You know, we're going to be enslaved and tortured and all these atrocities. So, yeah, when you do have a movie like The Yankee Doodle Dandy and you do have just, you know, as an example of, yeah, people think, oh, they're just beating the war drum, but they're championing the cause that, you know, we're the United States of America. We aren't going to take shit off anybody. We're going to stomp your dick into the dirt, and that's that. So
the end.
And when you have a team like the Army Black Knights that is kicking the dog piss out of everybody on the gridiron, yeah, people are going to get fired up, and people are going to get behind them, you know.
Well, that's the thing, is it's kind of serendipitous in a way, because the team wasn't necessarily a standout, and they for all intents and purposes, it's ironic, in a military academy, they lacked a good leader in a football coach. But in the 1940s, the kind of godfather of coaching at West Point came along. His name was Earl Red Blake, and he had an army. He had a record of 121 victories by the time he was done, which is 33 defeats and 10 ties, with 5 unbeaten seasons. He, as a young man, graduated from Miami University in Ohio, and isn't that where Big Ben went?
Yes, it is.
Yes,
the greatest NFL quarterback of all time.
Another great alumni. Yes, absolutely. Stay out of the bathroom, though. And entered the academy during World War I.
Yeah.
He was an All-American. He was an All-American
don't,
tight end.
Don't drop the soap.
Big Ben don't get on his motorcycle either. He was an All-American tight end. He received a degree in 1920 and was named the best athlete in his class, which is really saying something. He went from real estate to coaching after his college career. Then he resigned. Oops. Lost my place. He resigned from the Army in 1922 and joined his father in a real estate business in Dayton, Ohio. He returned to coaching as an unpaid assistant of George Little, who had been his coach at Miami. And he coached in Wisconsin in 1925. Signed on there with George Little in 1925 in Wisconsin. Then he went to Army as an assistant coach in 1927. And then he became the head coach at Dartmouth. Did I say that right? Dartmouth?
Yeah.
In 1934. I know a ton about colleges. His team
Ivy League.
Right? Is that how you say that shit?
The Cavs were unbeaten through 21 games, the first of several such streaks for Coach Blake. West Point called him in 1941, and after a series of losing seasons, just a couple getting started under the under officer coaches. They would have officers from the Army come in and like try to teach or try to coach the football team. They were active duty officers, and he basically came in and said, like, "Listen, I'm a football coach.
You don't know shit.
You need to listen to me." So Army's team reached its pinnacle of success during the Red Blake era, during the Second World War, when Army won three consecutive national championships, which is, put that in today's context, and it is hard to imagine.
We haven't had, when is the last three-peat, you know, we know Alabama as the dominant team of this generation, and I think they went back-to-back one time. Obviously, you know, take nothing away from what they've been able to do.
No, not at all. But it's that's just to add context to what Army did. They have 1944, 1945, and 1946. They won three consecutive national championships, and they also produced three Heisman Trophy winners: Doc Blanchard in 1945, Glenn Davis in 1946, and later Pete Dawkins in 1958. And they had past NFL coaches Vince Lombardi and Bill Parcells were Army coaches early on in their careers. So they've Army football has had a long reach in the annals of American football in as a whole.
Yeah, and you know the question kind of you know it becomes like, well, without World War II, would they have had the success? Would they have had the athletes there? Would they have?
I really think it was serendipitous. It set the stage for them. It came along where the Army had its pick of the top guys. They all wanted to go there. The country was, you know, looking for a team like that to come along, especially in the later years of the war. And then they really it gave them something to latch onto that was both a sport and a representation of how strong their military was and how they were going to prevail in the end. Actually, during the Battle of the Bulge in 1944, U.S. troops would use Glenn Davis and Doc Blanchard's name as a security code. When in doubt of who was in the next foxhole, a GI would yell out, "Blanchard," and because that meant like any American would surely know that these two names were connected, and his counterpart was supposed to yell back, "Davis."
Yeah.
If you didn't do that, they were going to throw a fucking grenade in that foxhole.
That is fucking awesome.
I couldn't even type this stuff out. I was so fired up.
Left side.
Strong side.
Yeah.
From an article on ESPN.com, in the war-torn decade of the 1940s, Army running backs Glenn Davis and Felix Doc Blanchard were more than American football heroes. They were the faces of young fighting men fighting the Axis powers during the deadliest conflict in human history. That is hard to read, my friends, without choking up. That is powerful.
And if anybody ever shouts Blanchard at you, you immediately shout back, Davis,
or you
might be choking on a grenade.
You are going to die. They were also known as Touchdown Twin. Doc Blanchard, he was known as Mr. Inside. He grew up in Bishopville, South Carolina. He's a big, stocky dude. Like, if you see pictures of this guy, he's like, you would not want to be the middle linebacker assigned to picking this dude up. He played, his dad, Doc Blanchard's dad, was also called Doc, and he played fullback at Tulane. And so they called Doc Little Doc. And Little Doc started at fullback in 1942 for the UNC freshman team. And he had, like, a pretty damn good season. Then he got drafted into the Army in 1943 and was sent to a chemical specialist team in New Mexico. But the Army, like, found out they had this badass football player there and recruited him to come to West Point. So they brought him down to West Point. And in 1944, he had his first year, and he finished third in the Heisman voting. He was drafted in the first round by the Pittsburgh Steelers after he graduated in 1947, but the Army wouldn't grant him or any of the other players a four-month furlough to play. So they had to, like, go finish out their service.
Yeah.
Blanchard became a fighter pilot. And in 1959, he was back in the news. He flew a plane near a base he flew a plane to a base that was near London, and there was an oil line on his plane that ruptured and a fire broke out. Blanchard could have parachuted out, but the plane might have crashed into a village that was nearby. So instead, he stayed with the craft and made a perfect landing, an action that brought an Air Force commendation. And then during the Vietnam War, he flew 84 combat missions over North Vietnam, piloting a fighter bomber during a one-year tour. He retired from the Army in 1971 and ended up passing away in 2009.
So in World War II, we didn't have the five branches that we have now, right?
No, the Air Force was still part of the Army.
Yeah, so basically, if you went to West Point, you know, that was like going to the Air Force Academy
Way.
Like, that would, if you wanted to be a fighter pilot and get after it that way.
It was the U.S. Army Air Corps until
1949, 47. Yeah.
Then there was Glenn Davis. He was Mr. Outside. He was raised in Laverne, California, which is a small town in L.A. County. He played at Bonita High School with his brother Ralph. They both attended West Point. Glenn Davis averaged, check this out, Glenn Davis averaged, he had an average of 8.3 yards per carry over his career and 11.5 yards per carry in 1945 alone.
This is not at Bonita High School. This is at West Point.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, I think, Reggie Bush had like a 7.9 or an 8.9, something.
Yeah, this guy was an insane athlete.
We all remember what a freak show Reggie Bush was to have that.
Glenn Davis ran like a 9.7 100-yard dash. Like, he was a freak athlete.
Yeah.
He led the nation in 1944 with 120 points. He scored 59 touchdowns, including 8 on his freshman squad. In his entire career, his single season mark of 20 touchdowns stood as a record for 10 years. And Blanchard set a then record 97 career touchdowns. Oh, I'm sorry. Davis and Blanchard combined to set a then record 97 career touchdowns by two teammates. The record was then broken by USC running backs Reggie Bush and Lindale White. I forgot about Lindale White.
And we were just talking about old Reggie. Lindale. That was Thunder and Lightning, man. Lindale.
That sure was. You knew who the Thunder was. Oh, boy, got second and third helpings. That's a little bit of Thunderstruck by Matt O'Brien there.
Was that in the right key? Probably not.
Yeah, we were trying to figure out what key Matt sings songs in, and like, we got it worked out a little bit. If you give him a little guidance on the guitar, he's not a bad singer.
Yeah. Well,
so for all three,
go that far, but
yeah, I'm just trying to be generous on the podcast. It's going to go out to people. For all three varsity years at West Point, Davis was a consensus All-American player. That is, selected by all different groups, picking an All-American team. In 1944, he won the Maxwell Award and the Walter Camp Trophy and was a runner-up for the Heisman Trophy. And in 1945, he was again runner-up for the Heisman Trophy, won by his teammate Blanchard. In 1946, he won the Heisman and was named the Associate Press Male Athlete of the Year. And in 1961, Davis was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. Davis also starred in baseball, basketball, and track at West Point. So he was a four-sport athlete at West Point. He graduated from West Point in June 1947 and entered the U.S. Army as a second lieutenant. He was offered a contract of $75,000 by the Brooklyn Dodgers, but declined as he was required to serve in the Army, and he figured he would be too old of a rookie after that. But in spite of Davis's service obligations, the Detroit Lions of the National Football League selected Davis for the second overall pick of the 1947 NFL draft held in December 1946. And in September 1947, the LA Rams acquired the rights to Davis from the Lions, so he applied to resign his commission in December, but was refused by the Secretary of the Army, Kenneth Royal, who must have been a real dick because he wouldn't
Royal
let any of
those. Royal pain in the ass.
No shit. He wouldn't let him out for even 4 months. Give him a four-month furlough. Which, I mean, it's a different time because the NFL was something much different back then. But
I mean, $75,000 signing bonus by the Brooklyn Dodgers.
That's
a shitload of money in 1947. That ain't a bad little chunk of money right now. And but I mean nothing compared to what it was in 1947. And so we kind of see the foundation of why college athletics have shaped the way they have, because it's very, very rare to see, right. You know, we have like Roger Staubach and David Robinson and a handful of players, you know, who have gone to serve as academies that have gone on and had successful professional athletic careers. But that 5-year commitment post-graduation that a lot of them have that they can't get out of, it makes it so if you have any hope of going to, you know, and a lot of the really, you know, smart athletes who could go to West Point, but they want to have a chance in the NFL, look at a guy like Christian McCaffrey who can go to Stanford and, you know, get a world-class education, but also, I mean, obviously that's debatable, but let's just call it a prestigious university.
Sure.
But
fair enough.
But obviously you would go there as opposed to going somewhere that is going to inhibit your ability. You know, now he can make millions
right.
of dollars playing for them Carolina Panthers. I think really, you know, old Secretary Royal, I think it would have been in his best interest, for all that athlete had meant to the country and to that university, to let him go and play pro sports, because, you know, there's been unique service by famous people, throughout.
There have been much greater exceptions made by the Army.
Yeah, exactly.
That's definitely could say that. David, I mean, to deny him even 4 months seems a little extreme. The sentiment was that Davis had been afforded an education at West Point, and like the popular opinion, I think, in the country at the time was because the NFL wasn't the conglomerate that it is today. It was that he should have to fulfill his military duties before, you know, going on to his athletic endeavors. But in hindsight, that seems awful harsh. I mean, that's for sure. In 1947, he and Blanchard were paid $25,000 apiece to star as themselves in a movie called The Spirit of West Point. Actually, it's kind of fucked up, though, because he ended up tearing a knee ligament when they were filming that, which would kind of bother him later on. Because it's like, you know, in 1947, what the fuck could they do for a knee ligament? Nothing. Davis served 3 years in the Army. While on leave in 1948, he attended the Rams training camp and played in a preseason game. He then reported for duty in Korea, how lucky is this? He reported to Korea before the Korean War broke out, and then reported back before it started. So he like narrowly missed being in the Korean War.
Which, yeah, certainly kind of has become the forgotten war in modern American history.
Definitely. If there was one you want to miss out on, that might be it, because it was a hellhole.
Yeah. Yeah, and so many people who were, you know, World War II veterans, and it's kind of like Friday the 13th, you know, just when you think the boogeyman is dead and down for the count, you know, Jason does his Undertaker sit up and rears his head at you, and it's time to get it on again.
It all happens in the form of a bunch of pissed off North Koreans with Chinese weapons coming at you. Worse than Jason.
Yeah.
But I digress. Davis was he served with distinction.
They didn't wear hockey masks, at least.
Oh, I mean, like, not a lot of them. They couldn't afford them. If you look in the old pictures, you'll see a couple of them.
If Kim Il-sung had the money, he would have had them all.
They'd all be wearing that with a goofy fucking haircut. So, David,
all the barbers, all the good barbers died in that conflict.
Good riddance. He served with distinction and ended up passing away in Southern California in 2005. And then Army ended up having some trouble in the early 1950s with a scandal that we'll get to in just a second. It was they had a couple of rough years, we'll say, and they went on to and they rebounded well, went on to have Mr. Pete Dawkins play for him. Pete Miller Dawkins is a hell of a dude. I had to kind of condense his extensive Wikipedia down to what I thought was a couple points, and even that is relatively extensive. Pete Miller Dawkins was born March 8, 1938. He's an American business executive and former college football player, military officer, and political candidate. Dawkins attended the United States Military Academy at West Point. He played halfback for the Army Cadets football team from 1956 to 1958. As a senior in 1958, he won the Heisman Trophy, the Maxwell Award, and was a consensus All-American selection. After graduating from the Military Academy in 1959, he studied at the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. Dawkins served as an officer in the United States Army until he retired in 1983. With the rank of Brigadier General. He was a Republican candidate for United States Senate in 1988. Dawkins has held several executive positions with Lehman Brothers, Bain & Company, Primerica, and Citigroup. This guy was he did multiple tours in Vietnam as an officer. He went to Ranger School. He graduated with honors from West Point and retired with full honors from the military. An extensive type A dude. Not the type of guy I would really want to like hang out with at a party and feel bad about myself after I walked
away. I'd hang out with him for a while and then, you know, see how it went.
I could put hanging out with him on my own Wikipedia.
I mean, if you have won a Heisman Trophy, I can get at least 20, 30 minutes out of you.
Sure.
You know, the interesting thing is, you know, he won this Heisman Trophy in 1958, and we were just having a discussion about Army's run basically just because of World War II and because, you know, like they had the North Carolina halfback who gets drafted and then they bring him in and, you know, they're pooling, you know, kind of just cherry picking who they want of anybody in the country.
Right.
Which certainly had something to do with their success. There's no denying that. But then here we are, you know, over a decade later and they have another Heisman Trophy winner. And this is not in, you know, during a draft or during wartime or anything, you know, this is just a badass dude who played at Army and tore it up. So it puts that, you know, sort of that into perspective for the fact that they were still an elite program.
Sure.
In a way.
And like as a prospective coach, like how would you, you know, a lot about football, you've watched it your entire life. How would you describe the game itself in the 1940s and 50s? It's much more physical, 3 yards in a cloud of dust type of game.
Well, there's a lot of the evolution of football. You could look at the evolution of and the improvements made to football equipment. The face mask, the helmets, all these things allow for a faster-paced game, more – you know, more hits and more things, you know. When you played back then, when you're playing without face masks you're playing with kind of rudimentary type of stuff, it was just a much different thing. You know, they didn't have
– right.
They didn't really run, like watching Army footage from this era. They don't really run, you know, your traditional, like, triple option service academy offense that they all kind of run now. And the reason they do that is because while they don't have the athletes that can compete with the top Division I programs, running the veer, as they call it, the option offense, allows them to kind of try and just find mismatches and do something different. And, you know, anytime you're playing one of those service academies, your whole week of preparation, where normally you're preparing for spread offenses or I formations and stuff, now you're preparing for this offense that you're probably only going to see once this year. It's a whole different psychology that you have to adopt as a defense to defend it. You have to be disciplined, and playing into that is what gives them an advantage by doing this. They kind of ran this like power formation at Army. Obviously when you have two monster studs in the backfield that you can hand the ball up to and they
makes
can
a
take
difference.
It to the house anytime. Yeah, I mean, it'd be stupid not to do that. But certainly the game, it's much, much different back then. Even from
sure.
watching, you know, the Packers play in the 60s and how they went about it. It's totally a different football game.
No, it very much is. It's a useful context to go over because it's like we're not a lot of people will try to compare apples to apples and say, like, well, I wonder how this guy would stack up against this guy today. It's like, well, it's apples to oranges. It's a totally different game. But these individual players, that doesn't mean people kind of – I think when I was looking up information for this episode, it was much harder than I would have thought to find stuff. And so it's kind of because I think it's so long ago, it's 70 years ago or so, 6 years ago, you know, last time that Army was a major, major powerhouse, that people tend to forget just how good these players were. And not just the players, but I mean the team as a whole. Like, and they really started rolling in 1944. The Army Cadets team, that's when Blake started really getting going. They had a 9-0 season that year. The Black Knights offense scored 504 points, while the defense allowed 35 points. At the season's end, the team won a national championship. The team captain was Tom Lombardo. In 1950, Lombardo was killed in action during the Korean War. They, like I said, a unique kind of facet to these.
Yeah, it's just terrible to think about that. And
but as an homage to the team, take a look at these scores.
Well, let me just jump in here first.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you know who won the 1943 national championship?
You know what? In all this research, I do not.
Notre Dame. I just want to add that because we're going to get to talk about I'm a Notre Dame guy. My family came over from Ireland in, you know, the mid-19th century. A lot of, you know, my family members have done the genealogy and history, so it kind of was not an option growing up whether you were a Notre Dame fan or not. It's not about what part of the country you're from or anything like that. So Notre Dame is a program that has a mystique and a tradition, you know, kind of unlike any other. So a school like that in a school like Army, which obviously we've been over the history quite a bit, make for just a natural rivalry.
Right.
And so while Notre Dame won the national championship in 1943, they got the shit kicked out of them in 1944. 59-0 at Yankee Stadium.
59-0, man.
To close out to, yeah. And
but to be fair, that was much better than Villanova did the week before in a 83-0 loss.
As you look over, you know, they played North Carolina, Brown, Pittsburgh. They played Coast Guard, Duke, Villanova, Notre Dame, who was ranked number 5. They played at Penn, and then they played against Navy, who was ranked number 2, which – you know, it's something that kind of gets lost in all of this is, Notre Dame had a great team the year before, but now it's Army and Navy who are on top literally of the world.
Right.
In every sense of that you can imagine. So they're having the best athletes and they're duking it out. A huge moment for the Army-Navy rivalry. But they never gave up more than – 7 points to a team. Most of their wins are shutouts, and they had a lot of – they either had a shutout or they gave up 7 points. And I got to imagine that probably most of those times they gave up 7 points was garbage time where they're putting third stringers in and it's a wrap, you know. They just dominated.
It's easier to count the games in which they – didn't score at least 50 points. There's like only 3 games out of the whole season where they didn't rack up at least 50 points.
And sometimes they're, you know, dropping 80 burgers.
80 burgers.
70 burgers. 69 burgers.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah, that is that's a track meet that you're going to. You're just...
Well, they kept that rolling right on through the 1945 season. The cadets... Earl Blake is really in his prime. They finished the season with a record of 9 wins and 0 losses. The squad also was recognized as the consensus national champion for the 1945 season. Before the season, the cadets offense scored 412 points and the defense allowed 46 points. And you can look again at this record and it's just blowout after blowout after blowout. Like, these scores in college football today would be unimaginable.
Well, and they happen, but it's when Alabama plays the Citadel the week before they play Auburn or something
and
like that.
And it doesn't
that.
Happen.
You know,
it doesn't happen 10 weeks in a row.
These are like the cupcake games, you know, where you see, yeah. So this is straight up domination. And these teams, you know, they're doing it. They beat, in 1945, they beat number 2 Notre Dame 48-0. And they played at Yankee Stadium, which, the real Yankee Stadium, not this amusement
right,
park bullshit thing
Fugazi.
That they made.
Right.
This is the real deal. This is the house of Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and my boy Yogi Berra. This is, you know, maybe the most iconic venue in the history of American sports. And they're putting on a show right here in the
They're
Bronx.
Racking up these scores, and these aren't passing off.
This is a bona fide national championship game that takes place. You know, this is number 1 Army versus number 2 Notre Dame, and
right.
people come out and just
48-0,
kick the shit out of them.
That's the second year in a row they've blown them out like that.
I thought the Alabama Notre Dame game 5 years ago was bad. 4 years ago, well, it's gotten, you know. Notre Dame has a proud history of getting the shit kicked out of them when they were in a national championship type situation.
Only during World War, so. Only when it benefited the country for them to do so. It's an act of sacrifice on their part.
Were we in World War 5 years ago?
Oh, of course. The 1946...
War on Terror, daddy!
I was going to say, we've been in one for a while. The 1946 cadet team kept right on rolling. Earl Blake is on his hot streak now at the zenith of his career. They finished this season with a record of 9 wins, 0 losses, and 1 tie, the only blemish on their undefeated record. The squad was also recognized as national champions for the 1946 season by several selectors. The cadets' offense scored 263 points, while the defense allowed 80 points. The 1946 Army versus Notre Dame game, the tithe in the entire season, the blemish on their record came in 1946 at Yankee Stadium. It's regarded as one of college football's games of the century, and I think it truly was, but it's not in the way you would think, right?
Well, it's a 0-0 tie.
0-0 tie being
and,
the century.
I mean, I fucking love it. You know, I love it.
Absolutely.
I know a lot of people don't like, you know, now there are no ties in college football. The rules have been changed. You know, we debate the game of the century, but something about the game of the century that people is kind of a commonality is that Notre Dame is in them. This was considered a game of the century. In 1966,
sure.
when Notre Dame and Michigan State tied 10-10, in what was it, like 1993, Florida State Notre Dame was considered the game of the century. So part of that has to do with the fact that Notre Dame is playing in major games that have national championship implications, but also Notre Dame, people love Notre Dame. And when you add the rivalry,
it would
of,
seem so.
You know, Notre Dame kind of being that, you know, maybe like the New York Yankees of college football. They were kind of considered
an
America's team type of deal, and so you had Notre Dame, who a lot of people were fans. They still travel better than any college football team. They have fans all over the place. But then you have, you know, it's World War II. There's all this nationalism, and you have Army, and they're on fire. So when you put those two brands together and you do it in Yankee Stadium, and Notre Dame had just got their ass kicked 2 years in a row, like badly.
Just blown out, yeah.
So, if you've seen the documentary Harvard Beats Yale 29-29, it kind of has that feel, though. It's like Notre Dame beats Army 0-0, like,
true.
Hey,
yeah.
We didn't get blown out by 50 points. Actually, we didn't give up. We didn't give them a drop, you know. And Notre Dame couldn't get a score to piss in the bucket that night, but they still held strong. And but you know, it wasn't enough. And Army won the national title that year. So we also
But they didn't lose. And it's a one tie on their record. It's the only blemish on that undefeated record. You know it's stuck in their craw.
Yeah. And when you have, you know, when you have, Just thinking about being in Yankee Stadium, Notre Dame versus Army, in a game like that is just too much, man.
Heavy duty.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. And when we talk about Notre Dame's, you know, relevance in this, and besides the fact that I'm a huge Notre Dame mark, obviously they play a massive part of the story. And they're
absolutely it'd be like doing a podcast on Ali and not talking about Frazier. It's like they're integrally tied, the rivalry, especially during that decade.
They made each other, you know, in this. And and Notre Dame has a quite a history with Servers Academy, and Notre Dame was an all-male school back during World War II, and because of the draft and everything that was going on, Notre Dame had super low enrollment.
Right.
And they were considering, they thought they might have to shutter their doors and close the school even. You know, it was getting pretty dire for them. And the Naval Academy started an ROTC program essentially at Notre Dame and sent tons of students there to study at Notre Dame and allowed the campus to flourish. And they actually doubled their enrollment. And so there's a bond between Notre Dame and Navy, and there's a reason, you know, that Notre Dame plays Navy every year to give them that prominence, to put them on that national stage and to pay respect to Navy. And Notre Dame beat Navy.
I didn't realize that, until you told me that right before this.
And Notre Dame beat Navy 43 years in a row until Charlie Weiss's fucking dumbass showed up. And to be fair, I think Brian Kelly – is lost to Navy as well. But once that 40, you know, that streak, there were so many close games, but we kept pushing the streak, you know, more and more and more, and then finally it snapped. But so they have in Notre Dame and Navy, you know, they have, you don't want to talk about reverence the way Army and Navy have for each other. They will both stand together for the alma mater, and the winning team gets to, you know, sing last, and that's a big deal.
Right.
So there's these traditions in college football, and I think the service academies and schools like Notre Dame play into that because there's so much respect and so much, you know, besides just the pageantry and all the other things about college football that you know, we love about it, you know, the people that get it. You know, there's aspects and there's a history to it that these institutions, you know, and I think having the service academies be a part of the history the way they are lends itself to that level of respect and tradition because it's such a huge part of those academies and how they operate.
Yeah, and then at that point, you're talking sports history, but you're also talking, especially with respect to the military academies, it's woven in with American history and it's and even world history. Like these things have all you know, connected in their own way and had their own effect because World War II had, obviously it had reaching effects to the recruiting classes of Notre Dame. So it's all tied in. It's hard to address one without addressing the other.
Yeah. And thinking about, you know, Notre Dame will play games. I don't know if they're playing Army. They're playing another game at the new Yankee Stadium. They have a Pinstripe Bowl now. Which Iowa just won this year, and that's played at the new Yankee Stadium. So there's kind of, even though it's not really Yankee Stadium, there's a tradition. There's just sort of a mystique about playing a football game at Yankee Stadium. And even in 1946, Army played at the Polo Grounds, which blows my mind. And any sort of baseball historians or, you know, if you played the new MLB video game, you can play at the Polo Grounds and you can see how ridiculous the setup was with the super, super deep center field, the super tight porch and foul and you know, like the foul poles are at like like, I don't know, they're like under 300 feet or something. And then there's this tight porch. So, like, if you can take it towards the foul pole, either way, you can probably hit a homer. But if you're going dead center, you probably, you might get it in the Parker. But just a crazy fucking stadium. Like, I wish that the New York Mets or somebody had the balls to just build an absolute replica of the Polo Grounds, because it is just fucking ridiculous. And it, you know, you think about like Fenway Park and kind of the unique dimensions that that ballpark has. It, I mean, it pales in comparison to the Polo Grounds. But yeah, so.
Well, we'll be starting a campaign to get the Mets to not
This is our goal. And, you know, interestingly, what happened today is that the Naval Academy, as we record this, the Naval Academy played a bowl game today. And they played against the University of Virginia. Now, we talked earlier about how essentially President Jefferson commissioned West Point to be kind of what it has become, the Institute for Science and Engineering and you know, the Military Academy. Well, he also designed the University of Virginia. And they got the shit kicked out of them today, 49-7 by Navy. So Navy and Army both had bowl wins in the same year, which I – who knows how long ago it's been since that's happened. Not really because of Navy, because they usually have a pretty strong program.
Right.
But it's been pretty rare for Army. Army's kind of been in the doldrums of college football. And they're having, you know, for Army, they're having a very good couple of years. Any year that they beat Navy is big. And winning the Commander-in-Chief Trophy, also beating Air Force, that's a huge year for them. And then also capping it off with the bowl victory.
I mean, they are on, they're doing well now. They have, they've been in the doldrums before, like after they had the they had a lot of success in the late 40s. And then in 1951, right at the beginning of the 50s, that's when they had the huge scandal hit the school. 51 out of 90 team members were suspended for cheating on exams. So there's a lot of, like, trading answers, and there's a big cadet honor code. So if you see anyone lying, cheating, stealing, either it's not that you can't do it. It's also that if you see it, you have to report it, or you're just as guilty. That was the only – so, like, he lost a ton of players, including his own son from the team. It was the only losing season for Red Blake. He chose to stay on, chose to rebuild the program, and by 1954, Army was once again a top-ranked team, thanks in large part to the integrity and fortitude of Coach Blake. A really unique guy to stay on and do that. I think he could have just easily taken his success and taken his ball and gone home.
Yeah, and we talked earlier about how I was at a, you know, like a military school. It's, they call it tolerance. If you're, you can be convicted or whatever you want to call it of tolerance. Like if you see someone cheating or you see something, some impropriety and you don't report it, you're just as guilty in their eyes, which to me, you know, I'm more of a live and let live kind of guy. Snitches get stitches and wind up in ditches. So that's not really my scene, but
that's the Coast Guard Academy you're looking for.
Yeah. That's where I belong. But also I think that, you know, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. And if you can cheat and get away with something and pass something, that's is probably a more valuable skill than you ever learn from what you're actually trying to do in that class. We're talking about real world skills here. So
So just remember when Matt is coaching your kids team, they'll be learning valuable life lessons like cheating.
Winning is the only thing.
No.
And, you know, I just want to add a quick aside, because if I don't get this in, I'll regret it. But we talk about how Army won in 1944, 1945, 1946. We also talked about how Notre Dame won in 1943. And guess who won in 1947 when Army's run was over?
Let me guess. Some kind of Protestant institution?
My God.
My God.
Forgive him, Father, for he knows not what he says.
He caved too damn hard.
Yeah, and the Irish are back on top. So, I just wanted to make sure that was stated, that their little mini run was bookended by a couple of Irish titles.
Cool. Yeah, we can just sum up the entire purpose for my, you know, 25 hours of research as a little mini run. That's cool.
Well, you're welcome.
No, but Army football sensei, I mean, they're not known.
Next week on the podcast, the 1943 and 1947
Notre Dame team.
The real shit.
A dynasty reborn.
Notre Dame football, 1947. I baptize you in the name of the Father. From Brandon and Matt.
since the Army, you were saying Army in total, they played in 7 bowl games. Like we said, they're not Notre Dame. We're not trying to be Notre Dame. It's a different
And they had a
altogether.
Lot of great years where they didn't go to a bowl game. And you know, there was no Taxslayer Bowl or Valero Bowl or you know, all these things. You know what I mean? You know, there was
like
the Rose Bowl and the Cotton Bowl and these things, but
2016, 2017, they've gone to consecutive bowl games with consecutive wins. So they're most assuredly on the upswing.
I don't think, you know, obviously for, you know, the Navy people and the Navy fans, I come from more of a Navy family. I've had cousins that have been in the Navy. I've had grandfathers and great uncles and uncles that have been in the Navy.
Right.
But I don't think anybody, you know, feels bad when the Army's doing well. It's a feel good type of thing in general.
Navy guys.
Because, you know, yeah, Navy guys might, but there is also, you know, it's a little thorn in their pride, but it's also, there's a lot of respect there. And if anybody knows how much, you know, if anybody knows how much sacrifice and the commitment and the dedication that the Army football guys and the cadets put into what they do. It's the people at the Navy, and it's the people at the Air Force Academy. It's the people at the Coast Guard Academy.
People, for sure.
So there's a brotherhood there that, you know, it's kind of a sibling rivalry type of thing also.
Right. Well, the team still today plays the games at Mitchie Stadium, named after the guy who started it all. The playing field itself is named after Coach Blake. Cadets attend. It's mandatory to attend the football games, and the Corps stands for the entire duration of the game. It's hard to read that without tearing up just a little bit. At all home games, one of the 4 regiments marches onto the field in formation before the team takes the field and leads the crowd in traditional Army cheers. Give me just a second. Though not being the national championship caliber teams of the 1940s, today's Army Black Knights are on the upswing, fresh off a bowl win, and with a bright future ahead of them, they still uphold the values and traditions laid down by so many before them and seek to serve something greater than themselves. This is what makes Army football and service academy athletics so great, the focus on the bigger picture, the insistence on integrity and honor, and the desire to serve are all traits that aren't found in such abundance anywhere else in sports.
It is, it's definitely a thing that, you know, if you get it, and that's why Army and Navy, they play on the day that they present the Heisman Trophy, which is a day where all the conference championships have been played. There's no bowl games. It's the only football game that day. It gets its own stage because, that is the respect that the college football community itself has for that game, even though it's not always the best game. It doesn't always have major implications.
But that kind of speaks even more to how much, how high regard
it's the game itself is what matters. And, you know, you're not going to find two teams that want to win more than when you've seen that game. And then when you saw Navy miss that field goal and Army storm the field and they're all white jerseys in the middle of a snowstorm, it's one of those moments in sports.
Moving.
Yeah. You know, that's what it's all about.
It's a unique experience and definitely something, glad we covered it. I learned a lot. Hopefully, everyone listening took a lot from it. Matt seemed to already know everything. That's, he knows everything to begin with. Yeah, so hopefully you took something from it. Yeah, I know. But, yeah, thanks for tuning in to this episode. We had a blast doing all this. Thanks for checking us out. If you are a listener and have any show suggestions or anything like that, you can hit us up online. We'll have all that stuff set up shortly. And we actually have a couple of questions that we've got through email here we can get to before. If you got time to answer a couple of questions, we got some.
Yeah, we can rapid fire a couple real quick.
Okay, we've got just a couple for Matt specifically here. We've got from Tilly in Elgin, Texas. Let's hear, just pulling these out of the hat. Can you make a shorter podcast? These are long.
Ooh, yeah. You know, Tilly, thank you so much for listening. And I hear Elgin is beautiful this time of year. I've heard great things about the Toyota dealership there. Actually, this podcast is probably just going to keep getting longer and longer because, that's
a big
really
fuck you to Tilly and Elgin.
Yeah, you know, if you ever had a podcast, you might fucking know that it's kind of an endurance sport, and as you go, you know, you get a bit longer with it. But hey, you know what? Break it up into different parts. If you're eating some dill pickle, you know, you don't have to listen to the whole thing while you're eating your dill pickle chips. You can slow down and listening to it when you're, you know, throwing rocks at the trains behind your house or something.
You'll not
you know?
Only enjoy the podcast,
you can find
more,
other
you'll
things,
enjoy your chips more.
Other things to do while you're listening to the podcast. I know personally, when I'm driving, I'll listen to podcasts. When I'm washing dishes, when I'm cleaning, when I'm lifting massive, massive amounts of iron at my own little miniature iron paradise.
I listen
here
to
at the
podcasts
crib.
While I'm writing this podcast.
Yeah, I listened to podcasts while I was actually doing this podcast. So there's plenty of time to listen to podcasts.
That brings us to our second question here from Tiffany in Seattle, Washington. What are some of your favorite podcasts? What do you like to listen to?
Oh, Tiffany, I hear great things about Seattle. I haven't been there. I had a buddy who played for the Mariners, actually. I'm a huge fan of seafood. I think it would be awesome, you know, the public market. I hear you guys, when it's not raining, it's really nice, right? But when is that?
I mean, just tell her what podcast you listen to.
Well,
running for mayor of Seattle.
One of my favorite podcasts is a podcast called All Damn Night, and it's a music history podcast.
That's a great one. That's a really good one.
Yeah, yeah. You should definitely check that out. They've got some really good stuff. I'm a huge music guy, so I would totally recommend you check that podcast out.
That's a good one. That's an excellent one. Very talented people hosting that one. What other ones? Like Hardcore History, Something to Wrestle With. Those are some ones that we kind of nerd out on.
Basically, Something to Wrestle With is kind of like a professional wrestling version of what we do. It's hilarious. Bruce Pritchard does it. He, as you guys know, if you listen to this podcast, you know that we grew up on pro wrestling. We find it hilarious and entertaining. And even when it's like pizza, even when it's bad, it's still kind of good. And like sex, but you know, I haven't had that yet, but I hear the same thing about it. But, and there's so many podcasts now, and we really felt like there really wasn't a sports history podcast like this yet. And you kind of look for like, what's kind of missing from the marketplace, and we're both history guys and sports guys, so it just seemed like a natural fit, and we're having a blast doing this, so yeah, thank you.
So absolutely. So there you go, Tiffany. And then one more here from Alyssa in New York. She puts a little winky smiley face in the subject line. What is your favorite?
Oh, I think I know
food?
Alyssa. I worked in New York for a few years, and yeah, Alyssa, are you still down at the inn, at the bar in the inn?
Yeah, I don't
oh
have
my god.
Phone line.
Me and my buddies, we used to have late nights down there she works at this hotel. Oh, in the bar. My gosh, Alyssa, it is so good to hear from you. Look, I know.
Are you sure it's the same Alyssa? I mean, it could be several.
I said I was going to call, and things just got crazy. I don't know. Some stuff was going on with my family. My dog was sick. Anyways, I'm really happy.
Your dog's sick a lot.
I'm really happy to hear from you. You know what my favorite food is. It's the buffalo wings. He used to make me every single night down there at the inn. I loved them. Extra blue cheese. You know the deal. Extra crispy. Get them wet with a hot sauce. So, yeah.
You know what? I misread this. This is Alyssa in Chicago.
Oh, okay. So she's at the hot dog stand. Yeah, my favorite food is the Chicago dog. Throw a little chili on there, a little chopped onion, maybe a little mustard. Yeah.
Multiple Alyssas.
Alyssa? I call her Lissy Boo. You were talking about Liss Liss. So, yeah, different girls entirely.
I'm sure they're both listening, and we want to thank everyone.
Lissy Boo, yeah. Liss Liss, I appreciate both y'all tuning in.
All of our wonderful listeners. Can't thank you enough.
And
really appreciate
as
you tuning in. And any parting comments to all your ladies throughout the United States and worldwide?
Thank you to all you baby dolls for tuning in. It means a lot to us. Now we're gonna close this episode. You know, we've been playing songs to open and close the episodes. Well, today we're gonna do something a little different. We're gonna close it with the same song that we opened it, and this is the fight song of West Point, of the Army football team. And if when you hear this song this time, when we're about to play it right now, and you feel a little bit different than the first time you heard it when we started this podcast, well, I think that means that we did our job.
Yes, sir.
So for Matt
and Brandon,
thank you guys for tuning in, and we will see you down the road on another edition of Back, Back, Back.